Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian. This is Insight number 104, and it's Friday the 5th of February. We're about a week ahead of Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, and Mr. Blandford's down for going there. You there, Rafe?
I am down for going there. I will be in Barcelona for the week, and actually this week we just posted some news on the site about how we're doing a whole bunch of extra video content, so that's over and above the usual sort of editorial and audio podcast that we typically produce out of MWC. I'm actually doing that in conjunction with Mr. Murr, Ewan McLeod, who is from mobileindustryreview.com, and we'll be running around the Fira in Barcelona, trying to give you as much of a flavour of the event as we can. We'll be talking to developers, looking at the latest devices, and sort of bringing you live coverage, sort of editorial thoughts, first thoughts, you know, grabbing people to get their opinion on camera and getting them uploaded. We'll be doing our best to upload some video while we're there, but we're also anticipating producing a whole lot of content which is perhaps less time sensitive, which we'll be sharing after Mobile World Congress. So, you know, you can expect sort of walkabout tours, and we've lined up some spokesmen from various companies, so there should be a whole load of extra video content. That's actually coming courtesy of some support from the Symbian Foundation, so thanks to them. Although I would stress that we retain all editorial control, but it's going to be very exciting and add an extra dimension to our MWC coverage this year.
And given that you're normally rushed off your feet for the entire week, you've just taken on a big extra workload. I guess the difference is you'll still be rushed off your feet, but you'll have someone videoing you being rushed off your feet.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, a lot of the time, the thing about getting it on video is that you can get that up relatively quickly and share it easily, whereas a lot of the time it's just getting your knowledge so you can come back and write it up and then talk about the podcast on the podcast, talk about the phones. But also, I'm going to be there for a little bit longer this time, and we're focusing on things that we think will be most interesting. And having an extra person along makes the logistics a lot easier. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to improve the coverage. And I know that Steve and Ewan will be doing their usual terrific job covering things from the UK as all the press releases go out, and they'll be digesting all the news and new devices. And I imagine we'll get them to share that on some special edition podcasts as well.
All the new devices. That sounds interesting, Rafe.
Yes, well, I think we can probably anticipate that will be some new devices. I mean, for example, I'm going to get my first look at something like the 6700 Slide from Nokia, which is one of their sort of lower-end non-touch devices, the one that comes in multiple colours. And that's, I think, interesting because it is sort of going to be in the same market. We've seen things like the 6700 and the 6300, which are sort of Nokia's mass-selling typical telephones, and they're previously been Series 14. Of course, that's an S63rd edition device. I wouldn't be surprised if we see more of that sort of thing being announced by Nokia at MWC, but it's always a bit up in the air. There could be all sorts of things from Nokia. Sony Ericsson, of course, has already announced the Vivaz, and it seems not entirely unlikely that we'll see another Symbian phone from them. That will, of course, be a Symbian One phone or a 65th edition. I don't think we'll be seeing this first of the Symbian 3 phones, but there will no doubt also be the NTT Docomo phones from the likes of Fujitsu and Sharp and others there. So there'll be quite a few Symbian devices that I'll be seeing for the first time, regardless of how many actually get announced. And we'll make sure we capture those on video and sort of bring some hands-on reporting of that. Of course, there'll also be the typical knocking of announcing some Ovi services. I expect we'll be sort of hearing more about the Maps offering and sort of the future developments of OviStore, which I think we can talk about later in this podcast as well. And Symbian are going to be, you know, presumably promoting the new version of the operating system going forward. You know, Symbian 3 in particular, the exciting news on EPL. And there's always a lot of other things going on at MWC, and certainly more so than we've done in previous years. I'm going to try and bring you, you know, a flavour of some of the other things being announced, be it the news from Microsoft, you know, new Android devices, trying to give you a more complete coverage, although clearly we're going to have a strong Symbian emphasis as always.
Yeah, you mentioned there that you didn't think there'll be anything announced running Symbian 3. I have to say, some of these devices from the likes of Sony Ericsson, Nokia, do often get announced 4 or 5 months ahead of general availability. And I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility we might see one device from one of those two announced as having shipping with Symbian 3 when it becomes available. Do you think that's just about possible?
Anything's possible. And, you know, the time frame is just about right. I mean, in terms of Symbian 3, It's going to be functionally complete, and what that means is sort of finished in terms of what are the features going to be in it. Towards the sort of beginning of March, I think, you know, Q1 is the official date, and then it will be hardened, which means it's ready for phones towards the end of Q2, which means it's in products, you know, we're talking probably July, August. So, yeah. Yes, I mean, you're right. And there's always delays possible in that. So it is possible. But I suspect, given how big a deal Symbian 3 is going to be, I wouldn't be surprised to see it announced outside of MWC, just because it's that little bit further away. And both Sony Ericsson and Nokia have been deliberately making attempts recently to announce their new phones closer to the actual release date. We've seen that, you know, back at Nokia World for Nokia, and also with something like the Vivas for Sony Ericsson. I think that's a trend we can expect to see continue. Like you say, anything's possible. And even if we don't see the phones, we'll certainly be hearing more about Symbian 3.
Yeah, okay. A few items of brief news before we get into the big item of news. New firmware for the N97 Mini, mirroring the firmware for the N97 Classic, brings RAM improvements and performance tweaks. There's new X6 firmware out in some parts of the world, apparently, although we're still struggling to get Mr. Spence to update his X6. Apparently, Edinburgh is a firmware-free zone, and for some reason, new firmwares don't seem to make it into Scotland. New 5730 firmware, that's version 200, new E52 firmware, version 31, and I'm sure there are others. I think Rafe and I have got to the point now, there are so many devices to check so much of the time that we do really rely to a certain extent on reader and listener reports to try and track some of these down, but hopefully we've covered the major ones there. So do check Nokia software update. And there's a question there that's relevant, Rafe, is that people have been saying, why are some firmwares for some devices not available over the air and you have to go to NSU? Others are available from moment one over the air. So why the difference?
Well, this actually has sort of multiple answers, so I'll try and work through them quickly. The first one is, on occasion you get firmwares that can only be updated via NSU because they're either a very big update and therefore it's too much data to download over the air, or they're updating something critical to FOTA itself or within the system core, which can only be done sort of with a flashing via a USB cable, because over the air obviously is effectively placing an update over an existing firmware. It's a bit more complicated than that. But these occasions are actually pretty rare, and they tend to happen only once or twice in a device's lifetime. I'm thinking back to some of the older devices where they had to be updated to enable firmware over the air, and sometimes there's a mistake. I can't actually think of a recent Symbian device. The most recent one that springs to mind is actually the MIMO device, the N900, which had to have a firmware update to prepare it for an over-the-air firmware update. The second answer to this is that quite often the firmware appear on NSU first and only later on NSU. Only later over the air. All these acronyms can get a bit confusing. And I know that's happened recently with things like the E52 and also, I believe, the X6. And it also happened, I think, for the N97 Mini. And these will typically have something, you know, in SW Update, which is a software update application that's on most of these phones now, you'll have something that says, you know, update via the PC. Now, sometimes that will be, as I say, the first explanation, but quite often I've seen now that the firmware's become available over the air only later. And of course, a lot of people listening to this podcast like to update their firmware immediately, but that's not really a typical usage pattern. You know, most people will do it a couple of weeks later or even a month later, or don't even update their firmware at all. Is there any particular reason that happens? I suspect it's a case of, you know, testing and certification, and we'll probably see more and more firmwares appear as just over-the-air updates, particularly the small ones. I know that's happened for something like the N86. The bigger updates will tend to be NSU. I mean, you also have to think about this in terms of downloading the firmware updates over a cellular network. It's okay to do an 8-megabyte one, but if it's 100 megabytes, it becomes less practical. So that's the thing. The final reason here that is worth mentioning is operator variants typically take a lot longer to appear. What I mean by that is firmwares that have been customized to the operator, and that can be something as small as bookmarks or tuning the radio for a specific frequencies on a network, which actually does happen and tends to improve the performance. in those cases, it takes a lot longer because the firmware basically has to be approved by the operator and tested and certified before it can go out, which is why the SIM-free or the sort of unbranded unlocked devices typically get their firmware much sooner, and which is why I'd generally recommend people buy a SIM-free device and then go on to a SIM-only contract, because the cost of ownership tends to be a little bit lower. There is an upfront cost, but you also get access to the new firmwares more quickly, and typically also being able to run the sort of new service on it more quickly. And honestly, I've yet to come across an operator firmware variant that really offers a big improvement. Even something like the 3 devices now, you can download the things like the Skype client directly from the operator portal onto a SIM-free device. So it's not like you are getting extra services that you can't get elsewhere. So there's a bit of a long answer to the question, but essentially it's there are reasons, but most of the time it will come over the air in time.
Yeah, I think my pet theory for why over-the-air updates sometimes take longer to appear is that actually examining firmware images and preparing some sort of block patching system where it pokes the appropriate blocks of data into the appropriate points in the Z drive, if you like, that probably takes a few days or maybe in a few weeks to prepare, program, and check and get that up actually online on the servers. Whereas if you actually produce a simple, here is a image of what we want to be in the Z drive, let's put it up on Nokia software update, I imagine that's a somewhat more simple system. So
that's definitely a fair point. It's doing the over-the-air firmware update as opposed to just flashing it via USB cable is technically a more complex process. And of course, you know, the over-the-air ones will typically get delivered to far many more people, especially now it tends to pop up on the phone saying you've got an update, whereas you know, it will only happen if you connect to PC suite or you happen to be watching the blogs for a firmware update for your phone. And I mean, my advice on firmware is still, if you're not having any major problems, it's not always worth upgrading, especially for the small updates. If there's a big bit of functionality you want, yes, it probably is worth updating. But, you know, don't necessarily get carried away. It doesn't always bring immediate and obvious benefits, especially as Steve will probably say, it's always better when you have a major new firmware update to actually start from scratch rather than restoring from a backup for things like applications. But discussion for another day, maybe.
It's all very well saying to wait, but you know us geeks, the listeners to All About Simulink Insight, we're going to see version 11.0.0.0.1 has appeared. I must have it right now.
Even when it's just fixing a spelling mistake on a single menu.
that's the one for us. Also in the news, very briefly, the new OviStore client. Now, 1.5 build 6.11 sounds distinctly unimportant. The subversion number has stayed the same, but it's actually a major, major update. Yeah, as you'll see from the screenshots, you've now got 3 tabs across the top of the screen, on touch devices at least, showing bestsellers, what's new, etc. Just in the same way that the Apple iPhone App Store clients, they kind of copied what Apple have done, but it does make sense, and it does make things a lot easier on non-touch devices. Rather than having tabs, you've got a small pick list at the top of the screen. You simply have a virtual cursor appears, you pop that over the pick list, pressing the D-pad, and the same choice of the what would be on the 3 tabs appears. So well done to the OviStore team. That makes a big difference. I still think the search function implemented on their servers could be improved, but that apart, the OviStore has been coming on in leaps and bounds, and the much vaunted major revamp seems to be happening piecemeal, which I'm not complaining about.
Yeah, no, that's exactly how we were told it would happen, a sort of step-by-step process. And actually, I think the search results have maybe improved, and they're actually rolling out a new version on the PC site, although it's not terribly obvious. If you look at the URLs, you can see some of the structure has changed. So I suspect there's some underlying database changes. The other thing that I noticed, that it may not be new in this specific release, but they're now making better use of the categories and the channels. So if you click on the channels thing, which is available under the options menu, you now get things like, you know, best recommended software, you know, best for business, best for consumer, best of 2009, some Valentine Day related ones as well. So they sort of created almost, you know, the equivalent of playlists for the music store. It's kind of app lists for the app store to sort of pick out some of the best things, which I actually think it would be nice to see them promote a little bit more, because it's a nice idea, because it's now getting to the point where there's enough content in the OviStore that it's actually quite hard to pick out the good stuff. So it's really nice to see the OviStore client come on leaps and bounds. It's also much quicker, I found, in operation. I suspect they've done some tweaking on the server backend and also in the client itself. So I'd actually say people who sort of are mean about the obviously all clients at this point actually probably need to go and have another go, because I think it's getting pretty slick, and there's certainly for the S65th edition devices, there's a lot of new content flowing in on a daily basis.
Yeah. Instantly, if your Ovi Store client seems to be stuck on an older version, which does happen from time to time, the way around that is to literally remove the client using the usual apps removal system within the S60 menu, and then go to store.ovi.com in web on your phone, and it'll prompt you to download the client again, and that will be the latest version. And I think that's the way I've managed to get around the non-updating. But certainly the newer versions of the Ovi Store client do successfully detect that there's a new version and successfully manage to download it, so people with recent clients shouldn't have that problem. Talking of the Ovi Store being rather expanded, shall we say, there was some news from Greystripe this week that you reported on. I rather worry here, Rafe. Apparently 1,400 Greystripe Java games with ads are all heading the Ovi Store's way. Won't this just clog things up a bit more?
Yes, I have to say I was a little bit concerned about this. I mean, what they're actually saying is Greystripe is a mobile advertising network, and they're making it easy for developers to add sort of ad-supported applications and games into the Ovi Store by announcing sort of official support for it. Apparently, developers can go to a self-service portal on the web, upload their application, and these sort of preload and exit ad screens will automatically be added. I think it's good to see that kind of thing, because obviously it will probably mean more free games in the Ovi Store, which I think people in general will like. But they also announced that they were going to sort of port over from GameJump.com, which has been running for a while, sort of 1,400 Java apps, some of which are, I think it's probably fair to say, are a few years old and aren't exactly high on my list of really good playable games. There are actually some real gems amongst them. I've got a couple installed on my phone from when I actually was looking at GameJump earlier in the year. But yes, I'm a bit concerned about the quality. On the other hand, the other way to look at this is for some of the older phones, like something like the N73 or some of those earlier non-touch devices, there is a lack of content in the Ovi Store. So a lot of these GameJump titles are sort of optimized for that sort of device. And we probably won't necessarily see them in the S65th edition list, but we will see them in the older phones. So it's good to see some extra content in there. And I think it does raise an important point about app stores in general, though, that discovery is the most important thing, which is why it's important to fix the search tool. But I think you can't really pick and choose which applications you take into an app store. Especially with Nokia's open philosophy, you have to accept everything, assuming it actually works on the phone it says it works on. And making judgments about application quality is a pretty slippery slope to get into. And I think what would be interesting to see is if Nokia, you know, does more to sort the list by you know, quality of applications, and so the ones that are bad and aren't downloaded very much tend to sort of sink to the bottom of lists, and so therefore become harder to find. And yeah, I think that's what we're going to see increasingly as the Ovi Store becomes more complex and sort of brings more factors into play in terms of things like social recommendations. And, you know, we talked about the sort of step-by-step approach, and that's certainly going to be happening in terms of the Ovi Store recommendation engine. Yeah. They'll start building in things like download statistics or review opinions or review ratings, and then they'll build in maybe a generic pattern of how people are doing it, and then they'll build in just based on your social network. So, yes, I'm a bit wary about that sort of thing, but I wouldn't be too concerned. And in one sense, more free content in the Ovi Store is only going to be beneficial, especially as we get sort of the number comparisons on how much is in any app store and how many downloads have happened. I mean, it was interesting to see that, you know, the 1 million a day downloads on Ovi Store was sort of confirmed in the Q4 results. And given the growth rate, I wouldn't be at all surprised if we, by, you know, MWC, sort of see that getting towards the 2 million mark. And you say, "Go, oh, well, what does that mean?" Well, actually, if you then start extrapolating ahead, 2 million a day would be roughly 700 million or so over a year, and the growth rate is still going. So it's possible to see that the Ovi Store will pretty rapidly get to the point where it's having very significant numbers of downloads. The big comparison is obviously the iPhone App Store, and I wouldn't be surprised if at some point this year we see the Ovi Store getting close to the numbers of the Apple Store and even accelerating past it, simply because of Nokia's scale.
Yeah, there's a brave prediction there from Mr. Landford. But talking of free stuff and talking of millions of downloads, one final bit of news before we move to the elephant in the room. The Ovi Maps free navigation, Nokia announced it's been downloaded 1.4 million times in a week, which it works out at more than one download per second, which is pretty impressive. But the big question that everybody's been asking is after the initial rightly deserved praise for Nokia for releasing in the first place is, will devices like, for example, the N96, the E71, even the N95 8 gigabytes, some of these older but really quite popular devices, will they get this new free navigation version? Or when Nokia say it will be rolled out for more devices in the future, do they mean future devices? Do you think these things will get backported?
That's a difficult question. I mean, the reason Nokia haven't said anything is because I don't think they want to disappoint people when they don't do it. I wouldn't be surprised to see it on some of the popular devices. I think you can pretty much guarantee it will be available on all S63rd edition feature pack 2 devices. The question is whether it will be available on the feature pack 1 devices, and of course that includes things like the N95 and the E71, and I'm not really sure I want to put my money where my mouth is and make a prediction. I think if at all possible they will, because they'll want to generate the goodwill.
So for example, the N86, N96 and E75, you'd be fairly sure they will inherit the Ovi Maps free.
Yes, I think it's the E75 feature pack here, I can't remember. Yes, I'm pretty sure they'll all get it, and indeed people will have found that if they download sort of a version for something like
E55 or E52,
it works on those devices but may not be completely properly integrated. So I'm very confident we'll see it for all the feature pack 2 devices. I'm just not willing to be so certain about the feature pack 1 devices. You have to bear in mind that there were actually some fairly substantial changes between feature pack 1 and feature pack 2, and I know that Ovi Maps does use some of that technology, and so the cost of backporting to those devices are probably much higher. But well, we'll have to wait and see. I know it's not the answer people wanted to hear, but I will ask again when I get to MWC. Yeah. I'm due to meet the Ovi Maps team, and so I'll see if I can get a more definitive answer.
Yeah, but so as you said, there are distinct technical differences between the different feature packs. And if you think about it, the E71 and N95, they're based on an operating system code branch from, what, 2 or 3 years ago now. And it's having the very latest Ovi Maps free, which even needs the very latest versions of the firmware on the things like the 5800 to try and get all of that working backwards on something that's an OS that's, what, 3 years old, I think is a distinct.
It's a challenge, yeah. And I realise people get disappointed, but at the end of the day, you know, when you buy the phone, you buy it for that. And the expectation that you get updates has become more prevalent in recent years. And I think it's a good thing. And actually, I think Nokia does deserve credit for doing that to a large extent with firmware updates for its flagship devices have got a lot better. And have they been forced into that by Apple and Android? You know, quite possibly. But when they first planned these devices like the E71 and the N95, that sort of thing was less prevalent. And, you know, at the end of the day, Nokia aren't a benevolent, you know, non-profit. They are out to make profits, and so they want people to upgrade to new devices. And I'd honestly say with some of the devices now, it's very worth considering updating, because you will get a much faster performance from your phone, and you will get better access to all the new services. And that, you know, you're only going to see more services coming out, and I'm afraid some of the older phones inevitably do get left behind. I appreciate it's not possible for everybody, and you know, could Nokia, you know, just make all the licenses zero cost on the store? They could, but there may be reasons they have chosen not to do so. Principally, they probably want to encourage people to update where possible, and you know, the idea that Nokia should be all benevolent all the time, I think, is rather missing the point about we live in a capitalist world, or at least most of us do.
Yeah, okay. Let's move on to the really big item of news. I wanted to leave this to last, just in case we got into chatting and it took over the entire podcast. Symbian Foundation has completed the move to open source. The platform, it runs on estimated more than 330 million devices across the world. It's been developed over the last 10 years. It's now freely available to all under the Eclipse public license. We'll probably come to the terms of that license later, and there's the different terms compared to other public licenses. It's delivered 4 months ahead of schedule, and it's apparently the largest transition from proprietary code to open source in software history. and is it 4 billion, like 40 million lines of source code. Rafe, you were there to interview Symbian. Can you summarize exactly what's happened in maybe 2 or 3 minutes?
Well, that's difficult for someone like me, but I will do my best.
What does it really mean? What does it really mean to the world at large?
Essentially, what this means is all the code that makes up the Symbian platform, and we're talking Symbian 3 here rather than any of the earlier versions. So it's actually not the versions that is currently running on phone, although clearly a vast majority of the code is also in those phones. But for reasons around sort of patents and software IP, it's not possible to release the older code. And frankly, it's not terribly useful in terms of what you can do with it. It's now completely freely available. You can go and download it. Anyone can look at it. It's completely open source. And so anyone can take it. They can do what they like with it. Well, there are some, you know, provisions in the license, but actually EPL has a pretty strong copyleft element to it, and so you can do pretty much what you like with it. What does this mean? Well, for developers, it means they can go and look at the source code and often fix some of the more obscure bugs. I know the author of Gravity generally tweeted about this and said he'd looked at some source code from a couple of weeks ago and actually was able to fix a bug in Gravity as a result of it. I suspect that kind of pattern will become more common. Of course, it's also the source code for all the sort of built-in applications, you know, Contacts, Calendar, and others available as well. And so you can go and look at how the official applications do things. And so there's potential for developers to have a whole bunch of source code, which they'll then be able to take advantage of and sort of replicate in their own applications. And the open source license actually allows you to do that sort of thing.
Yes, I wanted to just say, Rafe, the Eclipse public licenses, as I understand it, the difference from that and other public licenses and with this, companies can take code, they can modify it to their own specifications, and they don't have to contribute that code back into the public repository. So they can do stuff that is proprietary to them, that distinguishes their application from somebody else's, and they don't have to share it with others. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. There is a sort of encouragement to contribute it back into the repositories, but effectively it means it's easier for device manufacturers to put custom code or change things or use the source code, the Symbian source code, in other projects, but not be obliged to license their code under the same terms. So that contrasts with something like GPL, for example, where if you combine other code into the sort of GPL, you then have to license that code as GPL as well. And that's sort of what's meant by copyleft. There's some good frequently asked questions on the Symbian developer website which cover this more clearly. But essentially, it means it makes it easier for, you know, Sony Ericsson, say, to do customizations to the home screen without having to contribute them back or without having to license them under similar terms. There are some sort of the license does actually encourage contributions back, but it's sort of less onerous in that sense. And that's what we mean by copyleft. The sort of real implications here, though, are for device manufacturers, I think, at this point in time, in that it makes it easier for anyone to come along and then take the source code and create their own devices with it. So it means potentially, at least, we're much more likely to see devices outside of Nokia and outside of even the phone space, potentially. The other thing that it does, it really enables Symbian's philosophy of openness in terms of its open governance model to really come to fruition. I mean, previously the source code wasn't available, so it was hard for outsiders to make contributions to it, but now anyone can see it and potentially make a contribution into the source code, become a package owner, and that's all the sort of collaborative approach that the Symbian Foundation is espousing, the idea that the platform will no longer be a Nokia-led effort, which clearly it still is at the moment. You know, 95% of the packages are still owned by Nokia. But Symbian sort of has a target, I think, of reducing that as quickly as possible. It's even said that by sort of 2011, 2012, that level may be down to 50%. And so it will become a much more the ecosystem or community-created platform with contributions coming from all sorts of people. And we've already seen that from the likes of Ixnos and Orange contributing some developer tools. And that process is continuing all the time. I think Packet Video have also done some contributions in sort of video codecs and performance. But by having it as open source and it's also available in repositories, the ability to check in and check out code in the Mercurial repositories means that there's a you know, a real genuine process in which code can be contributed in, whereas previously it was with the Symbian Foundation license, which is what it was licensed under before, it was really only available to Symbian Foundation members, and it could really only be updated by people like Nokia. So that's the big significance here. And you know, what does that implication just have? I mean, people have been asking me, does this have any immediate relevance? Well, in one sense, no. In theory, you can actually start building it onto real devices right now, and we'll have more of that on the site in a minute, and I know Steve's going to come back to a question in a minute. But really, what this does is it's as much about the future as anything, and it means we'll have an acceleration, I think, of the ideas, features, and innovations coming into the platform, and it positions Symbian very well, I think, compared to its competitors, because I think when we're talking about something as complex as a, you know, a platform that contains 40 million lines of code, and just out of interest, I worked out that that's roughly three times the height of Nelson's Column if you print it out on A4 paper and stack them one on top of the other. What it means is that that sort of pace of acceleration can be faster simply because there's more eyes on the code, there's more people looking at it, and it's actually in the interest of everyone to build these sort of building blocks of enablement. And you know, Symbian say this unlocks the unlimited potential of mobile development, and it's easy to sort of get caught up in all the excitement around it, but there is a genuine sense that this is a different way of working to what's been done before, and I think it generally can accelerate, you know, the input of new ideas and innovation. But I know, Steve, you wanted to ask a bit about firmwares and some of the practical implications right now.
Yeah, I'm just going to give you a break from talking for a moment. I was looking at a question from Enfors in our forums on your news story for this. And although in one sense his question is incredibly naive, and I shall come to that in a moment, it's also a frequently asked question. It's sort of question that the average smartphone owner would ask. So let's just go through it. This is what he says. If Symbian really would go completely open source, Enfors says, that would mean I'd be able to create a new firmware for my own phone, like my Nokia N93. I could fix some of its age-old bugs and install it in my own phone. And this is the reason this I think is unrealistic and so naive is if you think about the journey of an operating system as it gets developed as a physical journey in the world. You set off from your home, and you move through a few towns, you take a train journey, you go across an ocean to a new continent. You move across the continent. 6 months later, you're having tea in some coffee shop somewhere in Sri Lanka. And they say, oh, yes, when you set off 6 months ago, there were a few broken twigs back on your front porch. What we'd like you to now go back and just pick up those broken twigs, please, or fix the twigs into a whole twig again. And it's 15,000 miles away, it's 6 months ago, there is just no way that that is remotely possible. And here we're talking about a device, in this case, an Enforcer's case, which is a 3 or 4 year old device, umpteen code branches, umpteen operating system revisions ago. And he's talking about a specific bug that Nokia, with all their trained engineers, at the time, with access to the current code, couldn't solve. So the chances of an individual user finding a really obscure bug in an operating system version 4 years ago from current code is just – it's so astronomically impossible, and it's almost hard to put into words. So in that respect, it is a very naive question. But people are going to be asking this question, what with this open source code, can I do anything practical myself? And the answer, to summarize what you've been saying, if I've understood it right, is no, unless you're a really good programmer. And even then, you're simply improving things for future phones coming in 2011 and 2012.
Yes, that's right. And I would also draw a distinction between open source software and open source hardware. You can, you know, compile the Symbian OS, and actually it's quite possible to do that, and you'll be able to do that for current devices as well. It would have to be, at the moment, the touch devices, you know, S65th edition. But you do need sort of some additional stuff in terms of being able to integrate with the hardware, and that's things like drivers. And while there are some drivers within the new open source release, it isn't for all the existing phones, for example. And manufacturers will sometimes be using their own drivers and applying the sort of source code on top. And what I mean by that is, you know, for specific chipset combinations or memory configurations and things like that. In order to get everything working, you'd also need things like that. Now, it's quite possible that we'd see that sort of thing released. And at that point, yes, it does become theoretically possible to create your own firmware. But you have to bear in mind that while through the Symbian Foundation, you'll be provided with the core applications and the core platform. Manufacturers typically add quite a few of their own things on top, and you think about any of the Ovi services, you know, be it Ovi Maps or Nokia Messaging and things like that. So the idea of rolling your own firmware isn't really practical right now. For enthusiasts, absolutely you could do it, and it would be nice to say see Samsung release the drivers for the i910 so that people could roll their own firmware, where there's already quite an active community around doing things like that. In terms of taking stuff right away, you can actually build it onto something like the reference device, which is the Zoom 2 from Texas Instruments, or do it onto a Beagle board. But typically, you know, existing phones from the likes of Nokia tend to be locked down, and you may well need some kind of security key in order for them to boot up a new custom firmware, and you need a way of being able to write that firmware onto the device. So there are a number of other steps that are sort of required to, you know, flash your own firmware. And I know people will compare this to things like Windows Mobile and Samsung, and Android. And it's maybe we see that sort of thing in time, but you have to bear in mind it will only be for the more recent touch devices, so certainly not the older devices. And even then, there are sort of some security things that are in place to sort of stop people, you know, fiddling with their phones. And it's, you know, for pretty good reasons. You know, manufacturers don't really want you breaking the security on it. That can be around DRM, but it's also, you know, stability of the network. You know, operators typically don't like homebrew devices going onto their network because they may be unstable. Will this change over time? It'll be interesting to watch. But in terms of people thinking, oh, can I go out and pick and choose bits of my own firmware, I'm afraid it's sort of more complicated than that. Sure. For expert users, that sort of thing I think will become possible. But as I say, it's really for newer devices and does require some extra things. And things like bootloaders, and that's to say they tend to be signatures that are required in order for it to actually boot up onto the right firmware.
I guess the big takeaway for people of slightly older devices, not necessarily as old as the N93, but, you know, for example, an N95 8GB user or an E71 user, there's actually no practical benefit at the moment, but it does give optimism for the future. And you can think, okay, rather than using a platform which everyone in the tech media says is dying, you're saying, oh, well, I'm using a platform, the next version of which is completely open and the sky's the limit on where it goes. I'll carry on with my investment into the, quote, Symbian ecosystem with buying apps and looking at devices with the same operating system with the interface I already know. We'll have small slight tweaks because I'm optimistic it's going to go somewhere in the future.
Absolutely. And I think the big message here is, you know, Nokia has made an enormous effort contributing this amount of code and really standing behind the Symbian Foundation as they've sort of coordinated the process. And let's not forget that most of the contributions are still from Nokia. You know, the Symbian Foundation itself isn't really doing code. And it's pretty amazing to see something like this happen. This is the predominant mobile platform in the world, and it's been made open source. I can't think of any other sort of industry that's had a similar move happen, you know, in quite such a dramatic fashion. You know, this is consumer electronics that are in the hands of 1/3 of 1 billion people, and it's moved to open source, and it's a new way of thinking. And it's easy to sort of, you know, be negative about Symbian for some of the press it's got over the last year. We've talked often on the podcast about how unwarranted this is, but it's really quite a staggering endorsement of the open source philosophy to see Nokia, such a big company, get behind this. And in a single stroke, effectively, they've become one of the world's biggest open source companies by making this contribution. Now, to put it into perspective, Android's about 10 million lines of code. Even something like the Linux kernel, which has been worked on by very many companies, is 10 million codes. Firefox is a couple of million codes. So by doing this, Nokia is making an enormous software asset available as open source. And even more importantly, it's something that's being used day in, day out. And it's almost a de facto software standard, as Lee Williams put it when I asked him about it. And that's unprecedented. And so anyone who's sort of out there who's, you know, an open source enthusiast, this is a massive endorsement. And why have Nokia done this? Well, yes, for them it is about cutting costs and getting other people to contribute to the code, but it's also because they fundamentally believe that this is the way to do business in the future. And to see this come to fruition is, you know, really quite exciting, and I think is incredibly optimistic for the future. And what it really is, an endorsement of the sort of idea that software at this sort of relatively base level becomes something that is a sort of a common community good, are Nokia still going to be doing proprietary stuff on top? Absolutely. That's what the OffiService layer is all about. But if they can create a platform that sort of gets more and more endorsement and used, it's only going to be healthy for the platform as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Talking about the platform as a whole, just a final item of news before we finish. I did a piece on All About Symbian about 4 or 5 days ago, collating the 2009 shipment stats for the different device manufacturers, which, and also for the different platforms. And just to end with a few numbers here, in terms of worldwide smartphone sales in 2009, that's the whole of last year, Symbian's market share was down 12%, which sounds dramatically like, oh no, down 12%, that's appalling. But they started at 57%, they're still at 45% world market share. And as I was saying in the piece, I think with the number of really active competitors it's got, from the iPhone and RAM and BlackBerry coming on strong, and Android, of course, coming out of nowhere, with all those competitors, I think actually staying at 45% worldwide market share is actually pretty darn good. And I'm with the open source model now happened, I'm just tremendously optimistic. I am a Symbian fan, and despite my work in other spheres in terms of being expert in other platforms, I am a Symbian fan, and I'm so reassured and so enthused that it's all coming good.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing to point out here is, you know, Q1, 2 and 3 were pretty poor for Nokia in terms of their smartphone performance, and they make up the majority of the Symbian sales. There was also a change in the way subsidies work in Japan, which resulted in some reduced sales there as well. But if you look at Q4, Symbian's market share will actually have gone up, and it's outgrowing the rest of the market. Now, this is primarily due to the fact that Nokia is using it on low-end devices, and I think that trend will continue. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to see that the market share remains flat even in the face of an increasing number of Android, yep, iPhone, you know, Windows Mobile, Palm devices. Certainly I don't expect to see a dramatic decline, you know, to 35% that some people have been talking about. Will it get to 35% in time? That's 2015, yeah, even according to sort of the more pessimistic analysts, and I think looking that far ahead is really quite difficult to do. So I think, you know, Symbian will remain above 40%, certainly for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I was trying to use the concept of equilibrium in my article, and I still stand by that. I think having Symbian at what it was, almost 60% world market share, I think was unrealistic in a healthy economy. And having all these competitors is great for Symbian. It's given Nokia and all the other Symbian licensees and Symbian itself a big kick up the pants and a healthy dose of competitiveness, and everything's changing for the good as far as I can see. And in a stable ecosystem, in an equilibrium, I think things will settle with Symbian up 40% plus and won't drop below that. But I do see Android and iPhone certainly and BlackBerry all coming on strong, and it's great to see a healthy world again.
Absolutely. And the big thing is, we're just going to see smartphones making up a bigger percentage of the overall market. And that's exciting because it means wider adoption of services, more applications coming in. So it's only good news for the consumer. There will be more, to use the horrible term, user cases or user experiences that will make it more interesting to use your phone. You'll be able to do more with it, and a greater variety of services. And that's only healthy as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We're way over time, Rafe, and we'll have to leave the rest for the next Insight recording next week. Hopefully we'll have Mr. Ewan Spence back with us. But for now, I'm going to say goodbye. You can follow me on Twitter at Steve Litchfield, and you can also follow Rafe on Twitter at
Rafe Plumford, and it's goodbye from me as well.